The 100 Years' War, the De Guesclin Period, The Good Parliament, Part 1. The Good Parliament, as it came to be known, met at a time of widespread discontent in England, the consequences of a long agricultural depression, aggravated by plague, cattle disease, and harvest failures. But the anger of the commons was due to grievances, most of which were directly related to the war. They included weariness at the high level of taxation since 1371. Disgust at the small military return for so much effort, and resentment against ministers who had presided over successions of expensive defeats. There was as yet no inclination to question the wisdom of the war itself, however. The complaints were about means, not ends. The disappointing outcome of the peace conference at Bruges added force to their anger and discredited its leading architect, the king's son, John of Gaunt. The English seemed to have cravenly given up a promising military position for nothing. The French had outmaneuvered them completely. Much of this was misconceived. The commons did not know about the diplomatic revolution in Paris, which had replaced the Duke of Burgundy by Louis of Anjou as the main architect of French diplomacy, just as John of Gaunt's peace policy seems to be on point of success. They knew even less about the government's financial difficulties. Edward III's annual expenditures on Calais were not £8,000, as the commons believe, but nearly three times that amount, and the cost had always fallen on the king's treasury and not on the merchants of the Calais staple. The king's government had never been able to pay for the war without parliamentary subsidies, except briefly in the 1350s, during a period of exceptionally buoyant customs revenues. There was not the slightest prospect of being financed from now from the modest revenues of the royal demands, however carefully husbanded. The king's ministers had indeed lined their own pockets, as ministers had often done in the past, but not to anything like the scale imagined by the commons, and certainly not on a scale which would explain the king's current poverty. Nor was there any great store of gold or silver to be found in their chests if they were to fall. The real problem, as the chronicler Froissart perceived, was that the victories of Edward III's prime had come back to haunt him. They had set a standard of achievement which was hard to meet, but equally hard to abandon. To the commons, who didn't understand the exceptional conditions in which England had triumphed in the 1350s, there seems to be no explanation short of treachery and folly for the turn which the war had taken 2 decades later. These prejudices were not new. If they proved more dangerous in 1376 than before, it was because they were skillfully exploited by men with strong vested interests and more focused complaints about the policies of the king's government. There were three main groups at work. The first and most active were the merchants of the Calais staple. They were closely connected with the mercantile communities of the city of London. By 1375, the staple merchants were disappointed and resentful men. They believed that their businesses had been ruined by the government's sale of licenses to export English goods to other ports. One side effect of these licenses had been to bypass the indigenous English wool wholesalers, since most of the licenses were bought by foreign merchants, generally representatives of the great Italian trading houses. This aggravated the discontent and spread it beyond the tight circle of staple merchants to the wholesalers of provincial market towns. In Parliament, Latimer and Lyons, who had been closely associated with the sale of licenses, found themselves the main targets of the staplers' anger. It is tolerably clear that the staplers were behind most of the allegations of financial corruption leveled at both men. The second notable group of opponents was the clergy, who had their own reasons to be suspicious of diplomatic maneuverings at Bruges. They associated them with an obscure deal which Edward III had negotiated with the papal legates in parallel with the better-known dealings with the French. For more than a century, successive English kings had sought to conserve the taxable resources of the church for themselves by limiting the power of the popes to levy their own taxes on the clergy. These arrangements had come under pressure with the pope's growing needs for money to fight his wars in Italy during the 1370s. As a result, relations between England and the papacy had become increasingly strained at a time when Edward III's ministers were trying to negotiate a peace with France under papal auspices. In June of 1375, at about the same time as the conclusion of the truce at Bruges, Edward III's representatives had executed an unexpected about-face. They reached a deal with the legates by which the Pope would be allowed to collect the subsidy of 60,000 florins, it's about £8,500, in return to agreeing to a series of promotions of royal servants to English bishoprics, including Pliable Simon Sudbury, who had been prominent among English negotiators at Bruges and now became Archbishop of Canterbury. The result was to expose the church to simultaneous demands from both Pope and King after 5 years in which the church had been heavily taxed to pay for the war on France. Many of the clergy were thrown into an alliance with other opponents of royal taxation. The clergy were not, of course, represented in the Commons. Their own assemblies were being held at St. Paul's Cathedral and in York Minster. But many of the prelates sitting in the Lords overtly sympathized with the government's critics, and others were acting influencing opinion at Westminster. On May the 18th, 1376, the learned Benedictine Thomas Brinton, Bishop of Rochester, delivered a sermon in London which, although wrapped in elusive conventions of formal preaching, offered an unmistakable hostile message. Brinton lambasted the king for allowing the spoliation of the church for the benefit of a few ambitious officials in search of bishoprics. He took up many of the Commons' grievances against corrupt and self-serving ministers. It was the duty of the Parliament, he said, to remedy these scandals. The third, and perhaps the most formidable group to join the miscellaneous coalition of the government's enemies, comprised a large section of the English military nobility. They were well represented not only in Lords, but also the Knights of the Shire sitting in the Commons. Of the 72 representatives of the Shire who sat in the good Parliament, at least 44 were real knights. Their collective experience embraced the whole course of England's wars over the past 40 years, from the highest points to the lowest. Some of them looked back on military careers extending back to the beginning of the king's reign. William Haselrig, a squire who sat for Northumberland, had fought at Halidon Hill in 1333 when he was 17 years old. Sir John Ensford, one of the members of the Herefordshire, began his career at the age of 13 at the Siege of Perth in 1335 and had been with the king in Flanders in 1339. Four members of the Commons had fought at Crecy, seven at Poitiers, five at Nujara. Sir Richard Waldegrave, one of the members from Suffolk, was one of several possible originals for Chaucer's Very Parfit Gentle Knight. For after serving in the English army, which attacked Paris in 1359, he had fought under the Earl of Hereford with the Teutonic Order in Lithuania, and had been present at the storming and sacking of Alexandria in 1365. But some of these men, including Sir Robert, also stood with younger men in the bleak marshes of the Pale of Calais in 1369, waiting for the decisive engagement which never came. Others had fought in the army which Du Guesclin had defeated at Pont-Vellin in 1370. Embarked on ships in 1372, which never left the coast of England, joined the fruitless march of John of Gaunt across France, 1373-74, or the abortive expedition of Jean de Montfort to Brittany in 1375. The knights were not a monolithic political bloc. Many were retainers of the king or the Duke of Lancaster, who are likely to have supported the court. But all of them belonged to a demoralized and disappointed caste, and as the Commons put it early in the following reign, they longed to participate in great adventures and achieve famous feats of arms, each in the sight of each other. So that's a little background of who's involved politically in this good Parliament. But we have quite a bit more of the good Parliament to go to. Now the sources for this, The Hundred Years' War, The Chronicles by Froissart, The Hundred Years' War by Perrois, The Hundred Years' War by Nylans, and The Hundred Years' War, The House Divided, Volume 3 by Sumption. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.